You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk about a political scientist, talk with a political scientist about possible changes to Wisconsin's campaign finance laws.
First, our next guest asks the same question Edwin Starr did in the song we're hearing, War, what is it good for? But unlike the song, his answer is rather a lot, really.
He makes the case that despite all the horrors of war, it's done a lot of good for humanity in the form of complex societies, advanced technology, and less violent lives and deaths.
Ian Morris is with us now. He's professor of classics and professor of history at Stanford University, a fellow of the Stanford Archaeological Center. His new book is War, What Is It Good For? Ian, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, this idea that war has made humans safer seems a little counterintuitive. I want to break it down some. First, you say we're less likely to die of violence now than in, say, prehistoric times, even with all the deaths brought about by war in the last century or so. Really?
Yeah. I mean, of course, it's hard for us to grasp this when you pick up the newspaper every morning or check on your computer or whatever, you hear about all these terrible things going on. But I mean, actually, while I was waiting on the phone for the show to start, I was listening to the Wisconsin Public Radio News, and the lead announcement they had was, there's been 34 gun homicides so far this year in Wisconsin. There's about nearly 6 million people in Wisconsin. And obviously there's other ways of killing people, murdering people apart from just shooting them. But you're talking about a rate of violent death in Wisconsin, somewhere in the order of 1 in every 2,000 people. If you lived in the Stone Age, your chance of dying violently was somewhere between 1 in 5 and 1 in 10, so far as we can tell. Just astronomically higher rates of violent death. Even in the 20th century, where two world wars, nuclear weapons get used, genocides get committed, there's somewhere between 100 and 200 million people die violently in the 20th century. But 10 billion people lived during the century. So that's a rate about 1 to 2%, 10 times safer than during the Stone Age. So, in a way, this is the single biggest story in human history about how the world got safer and safer.
Well, and let's take it step by step now. You say war makes states, the governments, nations, and states make peace. How so?
That's right, yeah. This is hardly a new argument. This idea has been kind of floating around since the 17th century, since Thomas Hobbes wrote his book Leviathan. It's just that now I think we've got the archaeological and historical evidence to really be able to see what's been going on. And this is a story that goes back about 10,000 years to the end of the last ice age. And the world warms up and population starts to grow and farming starts and the world starts getting more and more crowded. And as that happens, if two tribes go to war and one side starts losing, in the old days, you could always run away and go off and hunt and gather and stuff in someplace else because the world was really very uncrowded. But as the world gets fuller, it gets harder to do that. And so we start seeing this process where the people who win a war will often swallow up the society that they defeat to make a single bigger society. And it's a really nasty process, always involves lots of violence, terrible things happen. But what then happens is, say you're the guy who is ruling this bigger society, and what you really want in the world is for the people you rule to get up tomorrow morning and go out and plow their fields and pay their taxes and just behave quietly and not give you a lot of trouble. What you really don't want is for every time a farmer falls out with his next-door neighbor, he pulls out a knife and stabs the guy and burns his farm down and kills all his cattle. And that, of course, is going to be a disaster for the rulers. So it's like there's this selective pressure on rulers to pacify the societies they rule. And the more they do that, the more they flourish as rulers. And, of course, lots of rulers don't fit this generalization. There's plenty of guys like Hitler out there doing absolutely destructive, terrible things. But over the really long run, over 10,000 years, this pressure is enough to keep pushing societies toward being more and more pacified. And the result of this is this 90% decline in rates of violent death.
So when we look back at ancient history, even up through the Roman Empire, we maybe focus a lot on the edges and all the wars and invasions and conquests. But you're saying that an expanding zone of peace outweighs the zone of violence that led to it.
Yeah, I think this is a pattern you see over and over again in history, whether you're talking about the Roman Empire or about the European colonists coming and conquering North America, that you get this expansion, which is almost always a really violent process. You know, the Romans invade Gaul, say, or Europeans come and settle in Wisconsin, and there's lots of violence, lots of terrible things happen. But then you come back again and look at the same place a couple of hundred years later. What you regularly find, you again, whether it's Roman, Gaul, or Wisconsin now, what you regularly find is the rates of violent death are way lower than they were before the conquest. And also the people, on the whole, are more prosperous. They get brought into these bigger societies. There's a lot more trade, a more sophisticated division of labor, and levels of prosperity go up as a consequence of the peace. So, yeah, I mean, it is a totally counterintuitive sort of thing. But I think this is often the case when you go up from short-term history of what we experience in our daily lives up to looking at the really big picture, the nature of the whole thing changes.
So can't we, though, get this ever-growing state, this zone of peace, without war? Isn't there some other path to get there?
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, in the song, Edwin Starr has this line, "Lord knows there's got to be a better way." But the really depressing thing I found when I was writing this book is when you look back across history, it's really hard to find examples of people just like peacefully sitting down together and saying, you know, if we get together, we form this larger organization, we can have, you know, more trade, more prosperity, more peace. Everybody will be better off. And you know, you would think rationally, surely this is the way humans will have done things. But you look back across 10,000 years of history, it's really difficult to find examples of societies doing this without violence and force being involved somewhere.
Well, but having things like, you know, organizing how we're going to use the Nile to irrigate the local desert, or we're going to get a trade league together to improve trade. Doesn't that lead to some of the things you're talking about?
Well, again, you look back over the long story, it's really hard to find examples of this working very well on a large scale without somebody being there to enforce it. And this is one of the things, like 200 years ago when 250 years ago when Adam Smith is writing The Wealth of Nations, you know, his big thing in that is that the real source of wealth is making bigger and bigger markets, you know, freeing people up to truck and barter as their natural disposition makes them want to do, exchange goods, have a more sophisticated division of labor, everybody gets richer. And Smith, the insight Smith is remembered for is, of course, you know, for markets to work well, governments have got to get out of the market and leave people alone to get on with things. But what he also said that we often forget is for markets to work at all, governments have got to get into them, because somebody has got to enforce the rules and prevent the bullies who, you know, maybe can't compete as well in a fair marketplace, so they show up with a gun and say, you know, I'll just take the stuff. Somebody has got to prevent that from happening. And you know, again, in principle, there's no reason why, you know, peaceful pressure shouldn't be enough to prevent people trying to use violence to solve their problems. But when you look back across history, it's really difficult to find examples of this being successful.
You've alluded to your next step already. War makes states. States make peace. War seems to be the only thing that leads there. And when this happens, we end up richer and more prosperous.
Yeah, that seems to be the big story. And but I think there's a couple of really interesting lessons that come out of looking at you know, this big pattern in history. And one of the most important ones, I think, is the way the whole relationship has mutated and evolved over these 10,000 years. And you go back, you know, far enough back as far as our records go, on the whole, there's just an awful lot of violence involved in making these bigger societies work. In modern times, there's a lot less violence involved in making them work. And modern societies, we're so much more integrated now. We've developed so much more sophisticated democratic ways of doing things that a lot of the time, there's a lot less state violence than there used to be. But I think the other big lesson that comes out of this story is we're not yet at a point where we can just say, oh, we have transcended force. There's not going to be any more need for force in the world. I mean, you just look at what happened in Crimea the last few weeks with Vladimir Putin. There are still people out there who are ready to use force to get what they want. And because of that, the stability of the world does still depend on having somebody able to kind of police the global order.
Well, but you do make the case that maybe we're heading toward a point where the evolution of war is making war more untenable in the future.
Yeah, I think, again, this is one of the kind of the big picture conclusions that you come to. In a sense, in the really long run, you can say that violence has been self-defeating. but this sort of unexpected side effect of people fighting each other in the Stone Age has been the creation of these bigger and bigger organizations, these societies. And this has been driven by violence, but the effect of it has been to make violence pay off less and less well. So, I mean, I think in a way, this is a very depressing story about how important violence has been in human development. But in another way, it's quite an uplifting story, that the violence does seem to be self-defeating in the really long term.
We're talking to Ian Morris about his new book. It's called War, What Is It Good For? He makes the case that overall war has actually played a positive role in human history and human development. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about war with Ian Morris. In his new book, War, What Is It Good For? He says war has played a vital role in the development of human institutions and has ultimately done more good than harm.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you make of this idea? Do you have questions about how it fits into your understanding of human history? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. Came back in with War Pigs by Black Sabbath, a real standard at public radio. Ian, this is, you say, the first song you mastered on the guitar. It's an anti-war song. You were not a military kind of guy, a war kind of guy. Are you surprised that you found yourself making a case for the positive side of war?
Yeah. I mean, I think this often happens when you start writing a book. It takes several years to write a book, and you get this idea, and you go out and start doing the research. And I find more often than not, things turn out very differently from what I expected going into this, going into the writing. And I think particularly so in the case of this one. I mean, if somebody had told me 10 or 15 years ago, let alone back in the days when I was trying to learn to play War Pigs, that I would have written a book making this argument, I would have been very, very surprised.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Sean on the line in Kenosha. Sean, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment about, you know, history. This is just something that I've read, that it's kind of human nature to look back at history and connect the dots and see things in a linear fashion, when in fact things may not be as connected as we think. So I guess my question is, if we look at very specific situations of war and peace, does your theory still hold up? I guess that's my question.
Gotcha. Thanks, Sean. I heard the dogs of war in the background. Ian, what do you say to that?
I think somebody came to the front door and set the dogs off. Yeah, I think this is something you see very clearly when you try to look at this big story, that the experience of actually living through war is very, very different from the impact that wars have had over the tens of thousands of years. And one part of this is, you know, saying how any specific war fits into the bigger story is always really difficult. I mean, one of the things historians always like to say is, of course, you know, we have the benefit of hindsight when we're trying to make sense of things. But say, I mean, you think about something like the First World War, breaks out 100 years ago. If you look at World War One right from the perspective, say, right after the end of the war, it's very hard to see any positive stuff coming out of World War One. But on the other hand, if you step back and look at it from our perspective now, World War One looks much more like the first round in a 75-year series of struggles over the control of Europe. Yeah, World War One, World War Two, then the Cold War. And the end result of all that is you've got a much more stable order has appeared. People are much wealthier than they had been before the war started. They're living, on average, 30 years longer now in Europe than they did 100 years ago. And I think perspective makes all the difference with these things. And yeah, and living through the wars is a very different thing from looking back on them from centuries later.
I think that's probably a gut reaction that you get a lot. I mean, when you think of not just the death from war, but the suffering of people in the military, civilians, mm-hmm. Affected by war, displaced by war, in Syria today, and any war we could name almost at random. When you weigh all that in there, it seems really hard to make this positive argument.
Yeah, I think the question you've always got to ask yourself is, okay, what would the alternative be? I mean, like you say, you're talking about any particular war. The alternative is, of course, going to be a lot less killing that's going on if the war hadn't broken out. But when you're looking at the 10,000-year story, because, you know, it seemed to me that really no other force except war has been enough to create these bigger, more peaceful organizations, the alternative, if somehow there'd been no process leading to the creation of the bigger, stronger states, the alternative would be we would still be living in a world much like the Stone Age, where we are facing, you know, a 10 to 20% chance of dying violently. Our lives would be much nastier, brutish, and shorter, like Hobbes said, than they are as a result. So again, you know, I think that you've always got to ask yourself, okay, what is the alternative to this?
Go back to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Ripon. Mike, hi. Mike, are you there? No, we've lost Mike. Let's try Tony over in Wallace, Michigan now. Tony, hi.
Yes, my question is armed revolution against the government as profitable as war against another country, or is it strictly profitable against another country?
Ian, I mean, that's what's profitable, I think, but...
I think that's a great question, though, because writing this book, trying to understand the big picture history of war, I'm claiming that the big overall effect has been that war has pushed the world to being this safer, more prosperous place. Of course, not all wars move the world in that direction, and the reason that some wars lead us toward a more kind of peaceful, prosperous state is that those wars are ones that have tended to produce the bigger societies with the more stable governments, the Roman Empire, places like this. Not all wars do that, though. And on the whole, civil wars tend not to do that. And, Syria, I think, is a great example of this. It's now starting to look like the Assad government may end up, in fact, winning this war. But for a long time, people were saying, the most likely outcome here is that Syria is going to split into three countries. They're going to be smaller, they're going to be less stable, they're going to be more violent, they're going to be poorer. Often, I think, when we're looking at a civil war, what we're looking at here is the breakdown of a fairly large society with a stable government and reasonably high levels of peace and prosperity within it. They start falling apart. The violence makes people less safe. So again, I think to understand how a particular war fits into the big story, you've always got to have some context.
Looking into the future, does the argument you're making justify a future powerful nation in wars of conquest and expansion? We're breaking some eggs here, but the outcome is going to be a bigger state that guarantees a pax, whatever the country is called, of the future.
Yeah, well, I think this is kind of the twist in the tale, the twist in the end of the story here, that the story I'm telling is about how for 10,000 years the world has moved in the direction of safety and prosperity. And yet one of the great paradoxes in the story is that we've now reached a point where the organizations we've created are so big, so effective, and the weapons we've made are so destructive that another great war of the kind we've had in the 20th century, say, which in theory you might say, that will lead to a world state, a world government, much more peace and prosperity. We can't have a war of that kind. Another war of that kind could potentially kill everybody on the planet. And so this, I think, is the great challenge that I tried to confront at the end of the book. Where is the 21st century likely to take us? And I think that one of the there's a lot of speculations you can make, but I think one big lesson you can draw, though, is that in the short term, the most important force for peace is a continuing kind of globocop overseeing the world order. And in the world we live in at the moment, the only candidate for that job is the United States. So the book, I suggest very strongly that the U.S., in spite of a lot of the things people overseas say about the U.S., the U.S. is the greatest force for peace and prosperity and stability in the world today.
In your book, you, I think, make the case that hasn't been a straight line movement. There have been peaks and valleys and peace and violence. It seems like one other alternative to what you just outlined is collapse of superpowers somewhere down the road and a new version of a Dark Ages of some sort where the kind of violence you're worried about increases.
Yeah, this is the pessimistic projection, of course. I think the ending of the book is, on the whole, fairly optimistic. I mean, it seems to me that humans, we can't wish war out of existence. We've been trying to do that for millennia. We can't wish war out of existence. But on the other hand, we are very good at responding to changes in the world we live in and recognizing when violence has payoffs that might potentially be positive, when it's just totally negative across the board. And we've been very good, I think, at reacting to these payoffs. And I would say that's the main reason why the Cold War ended as it did, rather than whether thermonuclear war breaking out, killing everybody. The Soviet leadership basically wakes up in the 1980s and says, you know, force is never going to solve our problems. And retreating from Eastern Europe might be a disaster for Russia, but it's better than the alternatives. And I think people are, on the whole, very good at recognizing these changing payoffs. But the scary thing, of course, is we're not perfect at doing it. And the world we live in now, the kind of weaponry we've got now, a single major mistake could mean catastrophe for everybody. So while I think the story has a positive ending, I think we're going in a very good direction, nothing is guaranteed.
So you, in making this kind of controversial argument, you come out with a fairly optimistic picture of our future in the next 50 years or so.
I do, yeah. I mean, I suggest in my book that the next half century is likely to be the most dangerous in the whole of human history, in that I think we can see all kinds of trends that suggest that maybe the American ability to kind of police a global order is beginning to weaken and break down. We're getting ever more destructive and powerful weapons appearing all the time. And this is a really, really scary combination. But on the other hand, you know, the big long-term trends do suggest that we are pretty good at working out our problems and moving the world in this positive direction. So, yeah, it's a fairly upbeat ending to the book.
All right, if we could just make it through that next 50 years. Ian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show. I spent a very happy year living out between Blanchardville and New Glarus in the early 1990s. So it's great to be back in Wisconsin, virtually at least.
All right, well, hope you can visit us again. That was Ian Morris, professor of classics and professor of history at Stanford University. We've been talking about his new book. It's called War. What is it good for?
What is it good for?
Absolutely. Now listen to me. I despise. Cause it means destruction of this life.